welcome to Death Watch, another episode where myself and my sometimes partner in crime.
Hello.
I'm Matthew Price.
I'm Matt Brown.
And we're gathered here today to commemorate another person who's passed away recently.
It's a thing that we do for this with
is our
spare
show.
Time.
This is our show.
For kicks.
So we're going to do a bit of a deep dive on, I guess, a famous cinematographer, if such a thing exists.
I would hope that the people, you know what, I'm going to wax your guys' cars for a minute here. I would hope the people who listen to this show would consider cinematographers famous.
That's right. Here's what we hope is that we're going to talk about Michael Ballhaus, who's a wonderful, accomplished cinematographer that worked for, you know, about 50 years, maybe, straight.
Good long while, yeah.
Good long while. Had, you know, tons of huge accomplishments, and we'll touch on some of those. But I hope that as listeners, you don't only have favorite cinematographers, but you actually know some that you're like, that guy's shit. Like, where you're right into it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, absolutely. I won't watch that man's work or that woman's work.
Terrible.
Yeah. So this episode's going to be dropping on the 26th of January, 2018, because we post on the final Friday of every month at modernsuperior.com. As Mr. Price said, looking at the career of Michael Ballhaus, he died last year in April, on the 12th of April, 2017. Just a reminder, you can support everything we do at Modern Superior by going to our Patreon at patreon.com/modernsuperior. Before we get to the show, though, it's time for roll call.
Hey.
Here's everyone who... We are recording this on the 16th of January, so here's everyone who passed since the last time we recorded.
Yeah, it's been... We have been very fortunate.
Yeah, it's been a pretty dry, dry spell for us.
Good 2018 so far. Some people we have lost, but in general, I would say we have been fortunate. So, since we last came to you, we lost... incredible veteran sportscaster Dick Enberg.
Indeed.
The author of Oh My, which I think is the greatest, you know, sort of signature move for a sportscaster.
Fully appropriated
oh
by
my.
One George Takei later
correct.
In life.
Well, slightly differently, but yes.
Yeah.
We lost We lost Bruce McCandless, who was the first American to fly untethered in space, which is a thing I remember from having a subscription to Discover magazine in the 1980s, because the first time you could see photographs of someone in space with nothing attaching them to anything. He had that crazy spacesuit that, like, you see in the movie Gravity with the little jets.
Yep.
And that was the first one of those. So that was pretty amazing. And we did lose him. He lived a long time because he was an astronaut.
Yeah.
Very healthy. Johnny Bauer, who was a famous goalie for the Toronto Maple Leafs. JB started when he was much older than the average player. He played in professional hockey until he was 45 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about sports, so I'm assuming my wow is appropriate there. But,
yeah, he's pretty great. We lost Rose Marie from The Dick Van Dyke Show, and many other things, and a wonderful comedian and wonderful person. And if you didn't get a chance, Rose Marie, at the age of 92, got on Twitter.
Nice.
It was fantastic.
Speaking of Van Dykes, we lost Jerry Van Dyke.
We did. I'm getting to it. Yes, we did lose
Jerry
Van Dyke.
Sorry, I didn't mean to pinch your montage here.
Whatever you got to do. We lost Jerry Van Dyke, star of Coach, Luther from Coach. Luther?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Anyway.
You know. I don't know sports.
It was a show, but it wasn't. All right. Anyway,
thank
you.
Yeah.
We lost Jerry Van Dyke. Who was just like a, you know, I mean, didn't have quite as many gifts as his surviving brother Dick, but still kind of like a wonderful performer.
Mm-hmm.
We lost Sue Grafton, who is the author of the Kinsey Millhone mystery novels, the ones that are like A is for Alibi.
No kidding.
And, yeah, so
oh,
she
I didn't know
she,
that.
She kind of redefined modern mystery writing. We lost Erica Garner.
Mm-hmm.
Daughter of Eric Garner and a pretty incredible activist for black rights and human rights generally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost going to roll us out.
Well, to let you get situated when we're recording this, we lost Dolores O'Riordan yesterday.
Correct. Yeah.
So that's where we are right now. That's what everyone is still talking about. And who knows? By the time you listen to this, maybe more people will have died.
Yes.
Almost certainly.
Well, we also, so just to round it out, we lost Peggy Cummins, who was the star of Gone Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We lost, as you mentioned, Jerry Van Dyke. And the last one that I want to pull out is actually kind of a personal connection. So Alan Blevis, who was a voiceover artist and certainly like in the top three voiceover artists in the world, did every big movie trailer, did like Out of Africa and like tons of stuff, did recorded all of the political ads for the Democrats for years for nothing. Even though he was like a huge amount of money to hire him for something commercial, he always donated his time for political ads for stuff he cared about. And on a personal note, was a family friend, like grew up with my parents. And so we, you know, it was kind of just whatever. It was a personal connection there.
Condolences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that brings us up to date. So that is roll call.
Terrific. So today's subject, again, is Michael Ballhaus, who probably most of us know as one of Scorsese's key cinematographic collaborators. Certainly not his only one, but one that he worked with several times. He was born in Germany in 1935. Apparently, Max Ophuls was a family friend. So he kind of grew up around the cinema. And
I have a story about that.
Yeah. Would you like to do it now?
That he decided to become a cinematographer when he went on the set of Lola Montez.
Oh, there you go.
And visited the set with his parents because they were friends.
Sure.
And saw the possibilities of, you know, what you could do with cameras and sets and moving. And it's so, Ophuls' style is that the camera's always moving and circling and things are circling. And you can really see in sort of the signature stuff that Ballhaus did. That there's a lot of that there.
So, for sure, yeah. When I was in school, Ophuls was one of the directors that you would look at in terms of mise-en-scène. So again, what is the relationship with the camera and the things in the frame and how those things are positioned and how they move and how
and
the camera
moves.
And
he loves spirals and you know, scalloped things.
Absolutely. And I mean, you like you said, you can totally see some of that in Ballhaus's work. And then, you know, a question that I think maybe we want to dive into once the bio section is complete is the question of what does a cinematographer actually contribute to the look of a film? But we'll get there. So again, so he you know was living in Germany. He came to prominence in the 1970s working for Fassbinder, so which is a big blind spot for me. I didn't realize that he was one of Fassbinder's key collaborators as well. I think he did like 16 films with him.
They worked together almost exclusively almost the whole way through.
Right. Yeah. So I've never seen any of his work. I was going to try to cram some in for this episode. Haven't done it. Maybe we'll do so in the future. Yeah, I was trying to like frantically downloading World on a Wire, and then I got like a German-only version, and nope, that didn't work out. But I will circle back. But then, yeah, in the 80s, he moves to the United States, and as I said, becomes one of Scorsese's key collaborators. Worked with him on After Hours, Last Temptation of Christ, which is the film that I'll be talking about today, Goodfellas, which everyone on the planet has seen, Gangs of New York, and The Departed. So really sort of skipped along some of the greatest hits from the Scorsese career.
Yeah.
Also, ironically, shot Postcards from the Edge, which we discussed last month in our Carrie Fisher episode.
So, yeah, there's a lot of strange connections in all of this, and they'll keep coming up.
They do keep coming
between
up.
Our previous shows and this show.
Yeah.
And that's certainly one of them, but there's more. There's a lot more.
Yeah. So before we get into the film's proper.
Yeah.
I thought it would be interesting to kind of dive, and I don't have the answer, at least in terms of Ballhaus, but it is interesting to contemplate what does a cinematographer actually provide to the movie that you're watching? Because from what I understand, and it is all just hearsay and some practice, that can vary enormously by director and by cinematographer, where in some cases the cinematographer is really there to light the frame that the director wants.
Right.
And in some cases, the cinematographer very specifically composes and makes suggestions for blocking and so on and so forth. And that, you know, can be a very fluid relationship based on who is in what role. So I always find it really interesting when someone says, oh, the movie was badly directed or this wasn't done well. You know, it's like, well, but do you even know who was responsible for the thing you're responding to? How much of the look of a film is on the cinematographer? How much is on the director?
How much is on the production design?
Absolutely.
How much is
the
editing?
How much was
lighting?
Come up by some 22-year-old kid doing previs that ended up in the final movie? Like these questions are becoming so fluid.
Always were in various ways, and there's a lot of talk about whether the auteur theory, which is this idea that there is a central person that pushes through a film,
mm-hmm.
whether it was ever accurate. I mean, it's a great way to analyze things through the lens of a human being, but is it actually, you know, truthful? I'm not sure. And Ballhaus is interesting on this level. So here's what I sort of first and foremost found out about him that I thought was really kind of maybe like the way to approach looking at his work. He always taught. He taught classes. Mm-hmm. He taught university film students starting in 1968 when he actually wasn't very old. And he taught always. And he worked with, both when he worked with Fassbender and then when he came to America initially and worked with John Sayles and worked with some other, like, who at the time were younger up-and-coming directors. Mm-hmm. He was the older, it was a student-teacher type of relationship. And so his approach was much more, they would kind of give him a problem and he would solve it.
Right.
And he would decide how to solve it. And in the case of Scorsese, it's much more like two professors
mm-hmm.
who, you know, so he's far more, on the Scorsese films, Scorsese far more just creates these very detailed shot lists that mm-hmm. he has to match. And then his role changes and it becomes more about, you know, coloring in the edges and like, not that he's not contributing, but he's contributing in a completely different way with someone who already knows kind of as much as he knows
mm-hmm.
and is much more in charge. I get the feeling that one of the reasons he liked working with Scorsese is because it was probably a more simplified working environment
mm-hmm.
for him. You know, he would, you know, have this stuff all planned out. He wouldn't have to spend so much time inventing.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, for sure. And I, you know, I think the... You know, certainly when you look at a Scorsese movie, there's a very obvious style to the way the camera is being moved, you know, the yeah. way the shots are being set up towards the edit, things like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think for a photographer in that situation, and I have to admit, like, of all of the motion picture arts, cinematography is the one that is the closest to magic for me in terms of I have no fucking idea. Like,
yeah.
I cannot do it. I am bad at photography. Yeah. Not like, yeah. I'm not bad at photography. Like, people are, you know, maybe too hard on themselves in that arena generally. But when it comes to the finesse.
Yeah, conceiving that, a look
yeah,
that you then achieve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah that a yeah. cinematographer can bring to a shot. I, you know, I'd be lost. Couldn't possibly. Anything that I've ever taken a photo of that looked good was, you know, 98% luck. And I, you know, the idea of how you could, you know, manage things like that through lenses and lighting and filters and you know, those kinds of choices. It's an incredible arcane art form for me. So I would just be guessing. But my guess would be when someone has so much knowledge about the history of film as Scorsese does and has such a specific idea of what he wants in terms of how the camera is going to perform, that's an opportunity for someone like Ballhaus to go in and do, you know, again, finesse, do detail work in the effects within the frame and the way the lighting, focus, those kinds of things are pulling the story through.
Absolutely. And he, you know, I think regardless of who was taking more charge of a process, all of the films are united by, I think, there's a few different things. First of all, he's the type of artist that I like the most in that one of his goals is not to be recognizable from project to project.
Mm-hmm.
So he's one of the, if you know it's my work, then I've screwed up
right.
kind of artist, which I really respect.
Mm-hmm.
Just and even just on the level of not being sort of prideful about your own work, right? Like just, look, it's not about me, it's about the project. But at the same time, his films are always, regardless of budget, they're always handsome
mm-hmm.
and kind of polished. They have a sheen to them.
Yep.
I think it's interesting that we both did films from the sort of mid to late 80s, I guess.
Yep.
My film is The House on Carroll Street, the Peter mm-hmm. Yates sort of mishmash of 50s paranoia and 40s film noir. And even though the films are remarkably... you know, different in terms of mise-en-scene, like in terms of where, how they're set and like what kinds of, one film is set in the year zero, one film is set in the year 1953.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different, but they both feel of a piece when put beside each other. And even though he doesn't necessarily use the same style choices every time, you put any two of his films together and you're like, I can see how the same person was involved in these. Mm-hmm. There is a certain consistency of kind of the elevated tone of them.
Right. So this would be the point where I realized that, you know, to us, it feels like we've been doing this show forever, but it is actually only our fourth episode. So we might want to remind listeners that what we do is we each watch.
Nope, just go.
Yeah, we each watch a film from the canon of the person who has passed away in an attempt to contextualize that work within the work as a whole. So I watched The Last Temptation of Christ for the first time, which, you know, is in terms of films to have not seen, that's a pretty big miss for my generation.
That's a pretty big matzo ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you watched The House on Carroll Street.
Because in addition to wanting to watch something from their canon, I think part of it is that we want to watch something we have not each seen before.
For sure. Yeah. So would you like to go first or shall I go first?
Well, I can go first, I guess, because I think...
So aside from not having seen it before, was there anything else that drew you to the work?
It was one of those movies that I knew about and I felt like always seemed like the kind of movie I would enjoy. I love movies from the 40s. I love noir. I am a big fan of pretty much everyone in the cast of the film. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just this, you know, it wasn't even a blind spot. It was just like a movie that I thought, I'll get to that eventually. And when I saw it, it sort of jumped off the page like, here's my chance. I can see it.
Right.
Beyond that, I don't think there was anything particularly like it was just that, you know, as somebody who worked at a high level and I had seen a lot of the Fassbender films, I had seen a lot of his catalog, so this was the one. There was no other reason or agenda there.
Gotcha.
And also, I think one of the great things about films that are a little bit older and a little bit more obscure is I got to go into it knowing nothing about really except other than what the cover looked like.
Right.
So I, you know, sat down. We had a little date night for this movie, which is always enjoyable.
Not you and I. No.
We're not dating.
No.
Are we dating? No. We're just friends, man.
This is a very royal we you just used there.
We're just friends.
That's fine.
Myself and my partner sat down and watched it together, and we both enjoyed it quite a bit. And it is a lot of pulpy fun on just a story level. Mm-hmm. And it also has, you know, I'm not sure how much someone who is a director of photography necessarily quote unquote looks for projects versus just, you know, works whenever there's work.
Yep.
But certainly I think he had some autonomy. It's pretty clear that it was a chance to do some riffs on Hitchcock. So I can see that being an appeal for someone who wants to make images, right?
Sure.
Like, can I sort of play in this space, this Hitchcockian space? So it has quite a bit of that. It has a very good sort of complicated enough story without being ridiculous. And it has a few real signature moves, including like a sort of climax in New York in Grand Central Station it's wonderful. That has everything you would want from sort of a big Hitchcockian climax, much like, you know, the falling off the building in Saboteur or hanging from the Statue of Liberty's nose. Like, it's one of those sort of like, we've got this iconic place. We're going to hang somebody in peril, and they're going to, you know, are they going to lose their grip? And it was like, it was great.
Right.
It was great.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what is, for those who have not looked it up already, what's it about?
So the bare bones of the plot is that Kelly McGillis is a woman who works...
God, I love her.
She is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I'm sorry we don't get to see more of her, although she seems happy.
Yeah,
she's fine.
Probably fine.
But she's living... she's out now, so she's, like, living this, like, very seemingly happy life away from show business for the most part. She shows up in films from time to time. Anyway, she is young and pretty and up for... She's being interrogated by... Essentially, the House Un-American Activities Committee. Mm-hmm. It's a witch hunt kind of interrogation led primarily by a pretty oily senator played by Mandy Patinkin, who seems like he was born to play kind of oily senators. He's right in his prime oiliness at this point. She refuses to testify. She's, I guess, secretary for an anti-government group, a left-wing group. Doesn't seem like a particularly their modus operandi seems to be helping new immigrants to settle, get services, connect with lawyers, that kind of thing when they need help. So it doesn't seem like she's not trying to overthrow the government.
Right.
They're just, you know, unfairly targeted by this witch hunt. Anyway, she refuses to name names. He gets her fired from her day job. And she takes, and so she needs to work. And so by coincidence, she takes a job reading books to an old lady,
mm-hmm.
played by Jessica Tandy.
Yep.
In the world's greatest grumpy old lady performance. She's so good. You're 1 minute late. One of those kind of performances, right? Just fidgety and fussy and great.
And the old lady turns out to be a Nazi spy?
No. Okay. The old lady turns out to live right behind the Nazi spies across the courtyard. So the house on Carroll Street is the one across from. So she's in the backyard and she sees the senator arguing with a guy in German.
Amazing.
There's some rear window in there. She's seeing through the window. There's some spy stuff, saboteur. There's some kind of a crazy plot with the people that are sort of running this house. And there's she quote unquote, so she's interested. She wants to try to find out what's going on. So she quote unquote like befriends one of the guys in this house. And then also Jeff Bridges,
mm-hmm.
who is the kind of the male ingenue lead in this, is the FBI agent that has been assigned to tail her and get intel on her.
So all that said, it sounds like there is quite a lot of, like, is there like a voyeuristic style to the camera, those kinds of things? Like, this would be an opportunity to use the camera to peer into other spaces.
There's some of that, for sure. I mean, I think it's 50s cars, 50s clothes, you know, old houses, New York City, or like Brooklyn, kind of. So mm-hmm. big brownstones, like it's all that kind of style. And there's some of that for sure. But it's really, it's a movie that plays around with paranoia a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I mean, it's also that it reminded me, it's the kind of movie that they made a lot of in mm-hmm. the 80s, these sort of like thrillers, and you go back to them and you're like, oh, this is so much better than I remember. Like, we regarded these as just run of the mill and you can churn them out anytime you want. Haven't seen a movie like that in quite a while.
Yeah.
Even kind of where things have downloaded to Netflix and stuff, they just don't make these like mid-range adult, you know,
they definitely
thrillers
don't.
That aren't, they're not trying to be like, you know.
Did the sexy thriller kill them? Like when Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct became incredibly popular.
Yeah, and then those things died off too, right?
Yeah.
So there isn't even those anymore. Like, I mean, I think like now you'd get something like, what's that Jake Gyllenhaal movie about the news gathering? Like, Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not necessary in these films to necessarily go to that extreme level of intensity the way that I feel like in order to get these films made, you have to go there now.
Right.
Like, we're going to just be the most, challenging, intense experience. Mm-hmm. You're going to be exhausted, but no, this is just kind of fun and enjoyable and
nice.
Yeah,
yeah, I do like a movie like that.
And the peril is there, but it's not. You know, there was no point at which I was
I didn't mean did the sexy thrillers kill them by taking over their spot. I mean, like, did it evolve into that and then have nowhere else to go? Because I think certainly by like 95, everyone was just like, well, that's enough of this shit.
Yeah, once Madonna's on the hood of a car dripping candle wax on a dude, where are you going to go?
Sure. Yeah.
You know. That's a real thing, by the way. Google it.
Yeah, I thank you. I often think of the Ridley Scott movie, The Counselor, as a weird attempt to get back to that. And I'm like, nobody wants to see that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not important anymore.
Well, actually, three of our friends. That's it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But we have weird friends.
Yeah.
Cool. That sounds good. I wasn't able to track down a copy or I would have watched along. I ran out of time.
I had to rent it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but
I think you rented the only copy.
Probably.
I think there's the one.
Yeah.
That's fine. So I watched The Last Temptation of Christ, which, you know, I spent a lot of my life being aware of because it was so controversial when it came out and it was such a big deal. And I was just starting to read about the movie business when it came out, which was 88. I would have been about 12 or 13 years old.
Yeah.
And
so too young. Not because of the content?
No, I was definitely too young to see it, but I was
I don't think you would have enjoyed it.
Yeah, I just was also aware that, this thing had come out and they firebombed a movie theater in Paris and shit had happened. And here's the most amazing thing about watching The Last Temptation of Christ for the first time. I don't know how, but somehow, in the 30 years since this film came out, I never learned what The Last Temptation of Christ was.
So that's great.
Yeah, I had no idea.
So you saw that movie the way I did.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Which is like totally ignorant of what was going to happen next.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I had no idea what was going to happen in the third act of the movie. And I guess, you know, I was aware that a lot of the controversy had been around the Mary Magdalene character. So I guess I sort of assumed it was the fact that he had this, you know, ambiguous relationship with her in the first half hour of the movie, although she does say that, you know, he's still a virgin and that they've never had sex or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I thought it was all about that. It did not occur to me that while he was up on the cross dying, we were going to do like a 25-minute hallucination in...
Is it a hallucination?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that is...
Or is it an
that
exploration?
That is a very good question, and I don't know the answer to that, and I am certainly not the person to ask. But that movie was surprising to me in a way that very few legendary films that you never got around to can be.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about it. It was neat, man. There's cameos in this movie that blew my mind.
Well, back to our first show.
Yeah, so Harry Dean Stanton shows up
as Saul/Paul.
Saul/Paul, and that is fascinating because, again, to like loop back to our first show, as we discussed, he was an atheist. He delivers an incredibly committed performance basically
as a total indictment.
Yeah.
And the first traveling preacher. But also, like, he completely indicts and completely endorses religion in the same speech.
Yeah.
It's an incredible... It's a highlight of the movie for me, actually.
Yeah, it's really something. Yeah. You have David Bowie as Pilot, which is interesting there is that he took the role after Sting dropped out of the role, so it was always going to be a rock star, which I'm like, that's fascinating that... No matter how this went in Scorsese's mind, it was always, a rock star.
And it was always going to be a British rock star, because the other thing the movie did, which apart from your reaction to the actual content of, you know, what they have Jesus doing or not doing compared to what we, you know, what religious persons would expect, his idea was that the disciples and the people who were with Jesus would talk like sort of native New Yorkers, kind of like working class Americans, and the Romans, when you saw them, would talk like British people with British accents. And boy, what I mostly remember about this movie when it came out was a lot of "Yo, Jesus." There was a lot of that kind of
You've mentioned that to me in the past. I gotta say, it played a lot better for me than I was expecting based on your tee.
Oh, it's
you've mentioned that, but to me it was like, I mean, I know it's not quote realistic, but also neither is Willem Dafoe playing Jesus.
It works just fine, but it's definitely one of those things that we just thought was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Like at the time, you know, why is Harvey Keitel
in this
movie? Why is he talking like this?
I thought it was an interesting way, particularly in the mid-80s, to shorthand the fact that these are Jewish people. That Jesus is surrounded by people of the Jewish faith, so we're going to have them talk like, as you would say, like they're in a fucking delicatessen in
like
Manhattan, you know,
gabooks.
And I for me that totally played. I you know, some of them, it was a little bit.
Victor Argo is
a
fantastic.
Little, a little too close to the Goodfellas side of the force, maybe.
They look, it's almost The Sopranos.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
But I also thought that was a really interesting way to position the character and the people around the character and to tee up the story. So, you know, live it up.
And so back to Ballhouse, though.
But I'm not done with cameos.
Oh, okay, fine.
Because there's two more.
All right, sure.
Andre Gregory as John the Baptist.
Yes.
So My Dinner with Andre shows up as John the Baptist.
Yes.
And for reasons that I do not understand, maybe you know, I don't know, Irvin Kershner, in his first acting role, shows up as Zebedee. And I'm like, what? What a strange.
But he's wonderful.
Pull. Oh, he's great. He's absolutely great.
He's absolutely perfect.
Yeah. No,
he has the exact right look for someone who's lived outdoors for
a long
time.
And you're almost, you want to be, I mean, I didn't do the research and I should know more about the director of The Empire Strikes Back than I apparently do, but maybe he, you know, taught acting classes.
Kershner taught film.
Yeah.
He was George Lucas's film professor.
No, that I did know.
So
I imagine that's
how Scorsese knew him.
I just can't believe this is his first screen credit as an actor. At the age of whatever he must have been, 60 years old, I'm just like, that's wonderful.
Too busy.
You know, just wonderful. Yeah, absolutely, too busy.
Anyway, he's great in it,
and
I did not immediately place that it was him. And also, he has, like, I do think there is an aspect of the way the screenplay in this film is constructed up until The Actual Last Temptation to be kind of like highlights from Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, we better make sure we do the speech where he turns the water into wine. We better make sure.
Yeah.
There was also a point at which, and just getting back to the shooting, There's a point at which he's standing outside Lazarus's tomb.
Yeah, I was going to bring
this
up.
And he does kind of like a move with his hands into the tomb, like he shoots his hands forward.
Yeah.
And I thought, somebody should recut this movie as a kung fu trailer. Because there's a lot of, as soon as you start to see stuff like that, like there's that moment where he turns the water into wine where it just cuts back to him and he gives like a, hey, wine. Mm-hmm. And it's, there. I almost feel like there's a way to like recut this entire film into a weird parody of 80s bud comedy, action comedy movies.
Yeah, absolutely. The second act of this movie, which is basically the...
Super Jesus.
As far as I'm concerned, the whole movie is the crazy Jesus movie. It's just he's a different kind of crazy in each act. Because in the first one, he's like this incredibly paranoid, anxious, self-recriminating Jesus. Second act, he's like the risen, I believe in myself.
He's super Jesus.
Yeah, he's super Jesus. He heals
and he does crazy stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And then obviously in the third one, he has this massive faith and redemption arc in his fantasy. I just not to divert from Ballhouse too much, but the thing that I found not troubling but interesting in the fantasy sequence is that at the end of the fantasy sequence, it's revealed that the temptation is Satan, that this little girl who has been his guardian angel.
This androgynous angel girl boy.
Amazing casting of this
I think
angel.
It's actually a boy.
It is a girl, but I mean, I had to look it up because it is a very, you know, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
But it is revealed that this person is Satan, and that, for me, I was like, that shouldn't have been. You shouldn't have the release at the end of finding out that it was Satan tempting him. You should have God was tempting him to find out what he was going to do, right? That would have been, I mean, I know theologically probably doesn't make any sense, but I was like, giving the audience the release of knowing for sure that he made the right choice almost felt like a bit of a letdown.
But I think, yeah, and I think you can argue about the ending of, you can almost argue about the ending of this movie as much as you can argue about the ending of Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that there's so much to debate around, is this a moral choice? Why is this, why does this happen? And I do think that there's value in a movie that says we're going to question everything before we ultimately affirm it.
Mm-hmm.
So the affirmation is earned.
Right.
Right. So there's this speech by now Saul.
Yeah.
Or now Paul. There's a speech by now Paul saying, go tell them. I don't care if you tell them that you're really just a man. They don't want just a man. You know, and there's this sort of sense that like, the existence of him, the symbolic existence of him, is much more important and actually valuable than the reality of him.
That was probably my favorite aspect of the entire fantasy sequence because it is the only one that you can argue would happen exactly the same way in either version of the timeline.
Yeah.
Right? If Jesus rose from the grave, Paul would be up on the mount preaching, and if he didn't, he'd be up on the mount preaching because again, it's moved beyond him.
Right.
It's very Last Jedi. Sorry.
That's okay. But to ultimately get to the end of this mortal life that he would have been denied otherwise and realize it's actually worth the sacrifice in the context of what I can do here.
Yeah.
Does seem to me like a very brave kind of affirmation of just the personal relationship to Catholicism that Scorsese has.
Yeah.
And it makes the reaction to this film, the kind of hatred of it, all the more curious. It's not a film that actually betrays the church.
Yeah.
It affirms the sort of core tenets of the church. It says they're the right thing.
Right. You know? And my thing is always, and again, I'm not a person of faith, and I'm not meaning to step on anybody's personal beliefs on any level, but when I see that kind of reaction where someone is clearly intelligently and emphatically and open-heartedly struggling with their faith and asking questions of their faith and what could it mean and this and that, for any group of people to look at that and be like, sacrilege, blasphemy, I'm just like, are you out of your fucking mind? Like, this is as intentional and insightful a reckoning with personal faith as you could possibly hope for. And if that's not what you want, what do you want? You know, like it just blows my mind. And I know the answer. Believe me, I do. But yeah. It just blows
my
mind.
They don't want anything to get in the way of the official story or stop anyone to think. And that's okay. There's value in a dogmatic approach to stuff, but they also want everybody else to do what they want.
Yeah. So it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I wanted to call out a couple of other Ballhaus things. So you mentioned the shot in the with Lazarus, which I was looking up Ebert's writing because that's what I do. He mentioned it as well. I wanted to point out that he uses, the lighting in general in the movie is obviously very naturalistic. It's it doesn't look like it's taking place anywhere other than where it is, except in sequences involving the divine, where things get very theatrical. He'll throw green backsplash lighting on a rock, or red or white, something that couldn't exist in nature. Happens a few times in the film. Occurred to me that strikes me as very Scorsesean, but perhaps it is very Michael Ballhaus. It's something.
Yeah.
I don't know what direction that idea flowed from. That idea of very bright primary color lighting in certain situations, but you certainly see it in Goodfellas as well, and in Age of Innocence. Now that I'm thinking about it, so definitely something that they did a lot of together. I think it's probably quite a famous shot. It must be. I've seen it before. Where he lashes the camera to the back of the cross as the cross is
and the cross
risen.
Is pushed up.
Yeah.
Woo! Yeah,
that's a hell of a thing.
That is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a few sort of like moments like that. There's also one other thing about Ballhaus is that he would like experiment and come up with things that had never been done before. He is credited officially with inventing the 360-degree dolly shot.
No shit.
Yes, he invented it for Fassbender for a dance sequence, like a ballroom dancing sequence where he had to go all the way around the actors.
Yeah.
Which is like an incredibly complicated, so you have to have actors stepping over the track and moving around, like incredibly complicated to do a shot all the way around someone on a dolly camera, right?
Right.
Yeah, so he invented that.
Wow.
The famously, the Steadicam shot in Goodfellas is his shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that kind of like, let's push this out and try something brand new, never been done before,
right?
Yeah.
And then I as much as I said I had seen the previous shot, here's something again that I had no idea was coming, and I don't know if it was Scorsese's idea, I don't know if it was in the script, I don't know if it was Ballhaus's idea. The fact that in this the movie ends very abruptly, like as soon as Christ comes back to the cross and he screams it is
and
accomplished,
he accepts and dies for their sins. You see him actually take on the sins of the world in his face and then expire.
And then the most amazing thing that happens right then is this perfectly cinematic event, which is that there's a film out, basically, like we flicker to white
actually better than that.
Yeah.
The camera broke.
Oh, is that? Wait, yeah. It literally broke?
For real. The camera broke.
No shit.
And light flooded in and flooded the negative. And they just, at that moment, and he was like, well, just keep it.
Well, okay, so I didn't know if
that was not on
purpose. I didn't know if that was intentional or not. I assumed that it was.
According to the thing I read about it, it was not on purpose.
So, again, as a way to express the ecstatic in a way that again feels incredibly personal to Scorsese and beautiful.
Yeah.
We're going to have this moment that can only happen in film, which was again, an overexposure. Beautiful. What an
incredible
end to that movie. Great. So those are, I think that's it. I think that's Michael Ballhaus. Did you have any of his other works that you wanted to name check on the way out?
I think having never been into Fassbender, I think I mentioned prior to the show, one of the things that stood out for me in Last Temptation is there's a lot of scenes in small enclosed spaces where you're in the space for a long time. Like he's in a hut and he doesn't leave. Like especially the scene in the Temptation part where he's in the hut with Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
He's in that hut for quite a while and reminded me a lot of a film that pretty much all takes place in an apartment, I hope I get this right. I think it's Bitter Tears of Petrified Cat, where it's all kind of in this really weird, lavish apartment with mirrors and carpeting everywhere. And it's like, but you just never leave the apartment, but he manages to shoot it like this very expansive, you never feel like, oh, we're stuck in here. Like it's never,
right.
So I think that's a film to try. I think the place to start with Fassbender is Ali, Fear Eats the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I wanted to say just about the relationship was that Fassbender hated him.
No.
Hated him.
Oh,
hated
wow.
him. Did not like him. And so he would often come up with scenarios that were purposefully hard to film and then go, you figure it out, Michael, like that. And like only privately would be like, yeah, I kind of figured it out. Like he didn't like, first of all, Bauhaus came from originally sort of started in German TV, mm-hmm. And then graduated to film. And Fassbinder always called him the TV director. Like, he was very derisive of his skills and stuff, and he would never admit to him that he had done a good job. It's like, I really quite like that, like, mm-hmm. dynamic. And he didn't like working with him, but he was like, well, but he does good work, so I'm going to keep going. You know, like, I just, that idea of a person's personality, like, saying, I don't have to like this guy to know that this is good,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. And I hope that this has interested you in going and checking out at least a couple of these movies, because they are worth seeing. In February, we will have an episode.
Yes.
But it is going to be a somewhat special episode, because you, Mr. Price, are going on vacation for several weeks.
So we will be recording that episode in advance.
In a couple of minutes, really. But we're not going to tell you.
We can't. That's magic.
No, we're going
to. Just in advance. You don't have to say it's right now.
It's right. We're literally recording it right now.
You're actually listening to the
right
next episode.
Now. We're exactly. There's no break.
Yeah. Do we want to say who it is?
No, that's what I think we'll reveal on Twitter as usual. But, and then, you know, we'll dribble this information out into the world in February on our usual time frame.
Yes.
But yeah, thank you very much for listening. Please get at us on Twitter at DeathWatchPod if you have any comments or questions. And of course, if you are a Patreon supporter of Modern Superior, you can find us on the Slack as well, or at least occasionally. Because there are whole weeks where I forget to go in, and then there are whole days where I'm doing nothing but. It's weird.
And I just, one other thing I want to say, because I think people do this sometimes if they're movie fans or whatever, they go, I'm going to pick a director and like see everything.
Mm-hmm.
Do that clearly you can't do everything for some of these choices because there's a lot more output, but try a composer.
Sure.
Try a cinematographer.
Yeah.
You know, look at somebody, look at a writer, look at something other than just the director to see what is the through line here.
Yeah.
It's a great way to approach it.
For sure. Thanks, everyone.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.